in the first convention here with you. And I want to bring again the love and greetings of the Northwest Indiana Bible students as well as the South Bend Extension class. They wish to have their love brought to you. And as our hymn suggests, you know, how glad we are for the mercy seat. It's one of the great and profound blessings that we have as the Lord's people, a place to go where we may obtain mercy. And you know, we live in the cohort of God's mercy, don't we? But the Lord is interested, you know, having received mercy, the Lord is interested in seeing what effect it has on our lives, whether we ourselves will become imbued with the same qualities that He has of mercy and compassion. And so our text is from Colossians. We could read from 12 to 17, but we're not going to read it all. We're just going to take the one verse, a very familiar verse to all of you. Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved. The King James says bowels of mercy, but really the word is compassion. Put on compassion, kindness, lowliness, meekness, patience, forbearing one another, forgiving each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. And so when we think of the thought of compassion, we not only think of it for the compassion that God has extended to us and giving us forgiveness, but how does this compassion play out in our lives? And we think of words like mercy and pity, forgiveness, and love and kindness. These are all words that go part and parcel with the thought of compassion. Now, just briefly, we want to pause and see how compassion played out in Jesus' life. And we're just going to take a few little cross-sections of His life to see what kind of a man, what kind of a person Jesus was as He walked among us here on this earth. And so we're going to walk along with Him on just a few occasions and observe quietly and humbly the way the Master performed and see how compassionate a man was He. In Matthew 9:36, we read, when He saw the crowds, He had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. You know, He just looked at the crowds and His heart went out to them. Just full of compassion. And He saw their plight, that they were helpless, that they were harassed, they were put upon by all the various forces in this world. And His heart just went out to them. That's just one scripture. That's just one day in Jesus' life. Matthew 14:14. When Jesus heard of John's death, He withdrew to a lonely place. He really wanted to be alone to sorrow. Even though He didn't go to visit John as much as He would have liked to, He didn't. And as much as the fact that He upbraided the goats because they didn't visit Him in prison, Jesus did not visit John in prison. Because we believe it wouldn't have been appropriate for Him to do so. It would have raised perhaps a riot if He had gone there. But He did sorrow deeply, compassionately at John's death. And as He went, but when the crowds heard that Jesus was coming to this place, they followed him on foot from the towns. And as he went ashore, he saw a great throng. And again we read, what? He had compassion on them. And he healed the sick. And because it was a lonely place, he also fed 5,000 people before he dismissed them. Now there were two acts of compassion on this same day, on a day in which what? He wanted to be alone and to be alone with the Lord and to grieve and to sorrow over the death of this great man of God, John, who was his cousin, by the way. Another day of his life, Luke 7:12-15. And here we find him at Nain. And we read, as he drew near to the gate of the city, behold, a man who died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, what does it say? He had compassion on her and said to her, do not weep. And he said, young man, I say to you, arise. And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And he gave him to his mother. That was just another day in Jesus' life, full of compassion. Another day, Matthew 20:33-34. Two blind men cried for Jesus to have mercy on them. And Jesus asked them, what do you want me to do for you? And they said, let our eyes be opened. And Jesus, in compassion, touched their eyes, and immediately they received their sight. And they followed him. Nothing more needs to be said. You get the picture. That was our Lord. Mark 9:20-25. And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And the father said, have pity on us and help us. Jesus said, you dumb and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him. And he didn't stop there. He added, and never enter him again. Never enter this boy again. Now, if he was just interested in, you know, assuaging the crowds, he could have cast out the demon and he'd have got all the credit and all, you know, the admiration for the work. And he wouldn't have cared whether the boy was entered again the next day. He'd have gotten all the impact out of it on that day. But that was not Jesus. Jesus saw the boy. He saw his distress. He saw the distress of the family. And in an act of compassion, he not only healed him, but he set it up so the demon could not ever, ever return to torment this boy again. See, he was interested in the individual, down to the last act of kindness and thoughtfulness. He wasn't interested in creating sensation, of creating splendid impressions as he could have used this occasion for, but his whole character was bent on bringing the ultimate blessing to this family and to this boy. Mark 5:1-19, we can't read it all, but there we remember the story of a demoniac who was healed. And he wanted to follow Jesus, but Jesus said, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how your Heavenly Father, the Lord, has had mercy upon you. Now, I didn't, you know, go through the Bible in any special study to find these events. As you read, you just keep running into one after another, after another, after another. It was Jesus. It was the way He performed. And we only have a small cross-section of His life. But probably every day of His life, we see that He not only was coming to suffer and die for us, but while He was here, how tender-hearted, how compassionate, how loving, how kind, how sensitive He was to the troubles of the people, to their sorrows, to their distresses. And in compassion, He healed them, He blessed them. And you know, the crowds loved Jesus. They loved to hear Him, not only because of the gracious words that proceeded out of His mouth, and not only because of the wonderful miracles that He performed, but they loved Him because He made the love of God glow in their hearts. When He ministered to them, they felt the love of God. They were like, you know, you would be before the hearth of a fire and you'd feel that warmth radiating from it. And so in Jesus' ministry, love just went out. And they felt the love of God in Jesus' ministry. Now, we learn lessons sometimes by contrast. We just spent a few days with Jesus. Let's just spend a few days with the Pharisees. And we'll see a little different situation, a little different mindset, and a really different heart. In Mark 3:1-5, here Jesus was to heal a man with a withered hand. A man who had a withered hand and he couldn't move it. And the Pharisees were watching this and they were just outraged. Outraged that He might heal a man on the Sabbath day. They were just waiting to pick Him apart. This is terrible. He was going to do this act on the Sabbath day. They were like vultures waiting to pounce on Him. And we read in 3:5 of Mark, and He, Jesus, looked around at them with anger, grieved at the hardness of their heart. And after this, we read that they sought counsel with the Herodians to do what? To kill Him. Now, if they had a sensitive heart and mind, no matter what they thought of Jesus and how they opposed Him, you would think that the very nature of healing a man with a withered hand, they would have at least said, well, you know, we don't agree with all the teachings of this man, but you can't take it from him. He really has done a wonderful thing for this man. And their heart should have been touched a little bit to see this man who was so oppressed with his affliction to be healed. But no, not only were they outraged with Jesus, they were so incensed with Him. They were so bitter, so antagonistic toward Him that they were plotting to kill Him. That tells you something, doesn't it, about their mindset and their heart attitude. Matthew 12:1-7. Here the disciples were walking through the grain fields. You know, they could walk a little bit on the Sabbath day, and apparently they were hungry. And under the Jewish law, the land belonged to God, and if you were walking along the road and you were hungry, you were free to go to a fig tree and take off fruit and eat it, or if there was a grape orchard there, you were free to go and have a cluster of grapes and to eat them as you went, or in this case, there was grain, And so the disciples grabbed a few heads of wheat or whatever it was, and they were shelling them in their hands. Of course, this is on the Sabbath day. Terrible thing. They were working on the Sabbath day, but they were only eating. And the Pharisees were watching this in an owl-eyed way, and they were just, again, they were so distraught that these men were eating and working, shelling grain on the Sabbath day. Now, it never occurred to them to say, well, now, you know, you don't have to eat this raw grain. Why don't you come to my house? And I've got lots of bread, and sit down and have some bread with us. They didn't say that. They didn't offer any hospitality to them. They didn't care how hungry they were or how much they needed the food. All they saw was that they were shelling the grain on the Sabbath day, and they were outraged. They wanted to condemn Jesus, and they wanted to condemn his disciples. There just was no compassion, no sensitivity to human need. And so they wanted these men to stay hungry on the Sabbath. And Jesus remonstrated their callousness, saying, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. You see, sacrifice without mercy is not acceptable to God. There must be compassion in the human heart. But did Jesus score any points? He didn't score any points with these people. He didn't touch them. He didn't reach them. You couldn't reach them with a 10-foot pole on compassion. Their hearts were hardened against him. Their faces were like flint against him. Again, Luke 7:36-48. One of the Pharisees, in this case, they asked him to dinner. And while there, a woman came and anointed Jesus' feet with perfume and kissed his feet, wiping them with her hair. And again, the Pharisees were outraged. They watched this whole episode. And they just stared in unbelief that Jesus would allow this sinful woman to touch his feet. They just were all bent out of shape. And they said, well, if you knew what kind of woman she was, you wouldn't have allowed her to touch you. Well, Jesus had a little message for them. And he said, a certain creditor had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, and the other 50. And when they could not pay, he forgave them both. Now, which of them will love him more? And Simon, one of the Pharisees, says, well, I suppose, a grudging answer, the one to whom he forgave most. He kind of had him extracted out of him, but it was the logical answer. He couldn't deny the point that Jesus was making. But when, and Jesus said, you've rightly judged. You've assessed the matter correctly. But then Jesus went on to do something else. He said, woman, your sins be forgiven thee. And oh, that drove them up the wall. The priests, they have the only right to forgive sins. The priest, under Jewish law, if you sinned, you were to go to the priest and make an offering, and the priest was supposed to be able to reconcile your sins with God and create some atmosphere of forgiveness. But when Jesus forgave the woman her sins, that just outraged them. Throughout his life, they faulted Jesus because of what? That he was a friend of who? The publicans and sinners. The Pharisees, they held the publicans and the sinners at arm's length. And as Jesus upbraided them, he says, you lay great burdens on the people, and you wouldn't as much as use a little finger to lift the burden from them. They didn't have any compassion. They just laid all these burdens on the people, and they held them off at arm's length. It was so different from Jesus. Jesus was so approachable.
He was so kind. And the sinners, well, they could come to Him and they could receive forgiveness. And He would tell them to sin no more, but we see that He said that the righteous don't need a physician. It's the ones that are sin-sick. They're the ones to whom He was sent. And so we see that while healing cost Jesus His vitality, the ministry that He afforded the people mostly was inopportune for Himself. It cost Him weariness. It cost Him exertion. He gave so much to so many, always with compassion. Why did Jesus enter so fully into the burdens of others while the religious leaders were so lacking in compassion? How do you get compassion? Why is it so important? You know, we're so glad for the mercy that we receive. But God is interested in seeing what we do with the mercy that we receive, whether we are willing to be imbued with the same spirit that God had when He provided the means for extending mercy to us, to see how it will play out in our own life. And I think that's the lesson. When Mahatma Gandhi was asked what worried him most, he gave a short reply, and that troubled a lot of people, but it was a very short answer. And he said, the hardness of heart of the educated. You look at history, you'll find that the aristocracy and the priestcraft, they were the educated. And before you are the open pages of history, the aristocracy and the priestcraft, it was they that oppressed the people. It was they that created the persecutions. It was they that created even the torture chambers. All of these things. You wonder, you know, the priests were not ignorant people. They were people in those years of the past. You couldn't, the only way you could be educated was to be a part of aristocracy or enter into the ministry as a priest. Education was denied nearly everyone else, unless you were smart enough to pick it up a little bit by yourself and learn to read. But for the most part, people just, this was out of reach for them. And so we see that, you know, society in our time, when education has increased, we find that there's still a hardness of heart that has followed us. I remember in the years that Medicare was being toyed with in Congress, guess who opposed it and spent millions and millions of dollars to oppose Medicare? It was the American Medical Association. They spent millions and millions of dollars trying to kill the bill in Congress. And then when it passed, guess what? They learned how to extort a lot of money from it, and they found it was a windfall. And the government has been prosecuting many of them for extortion of the Medicare system. And I'm not faulting the doctors. I use them, and they've done a lot of wonderful service. But it's just in the nature of things that, you know, in the old days, when the doctor performed his he went the rounds, he went into the homes. And, you know, he couldn't turn in a bill very well when he went into a home and found that there were six kids and the cupboard was bare and the mother was sick. You know, he'd take a chicken down the road or whatever they would give him. And, you know, the doctor performed with a lot of compassion. But nowadays, what we've done, we've insulated the doctor from the plight of the people. He doesn't know. You know, it's all done through a billing process, and it's all done through paperwork and computers, and he doesn't know, and what's more, he doesn't care how the money comes. He just hands in the bills, and somehow, hopefully, the money will come down the pipeline somewhere. And so we're insulated from people. And this is what helps harden our hearts. It's just like the queen. You know, when she would go through the slums of the city, the ghetto, what would she do? Well, she didn't want to look at the plight of the poor. She didn't want to see those poor waifs standing in the street, barefoot and hungry. She'd tell the servants to just pull the blinds on the carriage. And when the blind was pulled, you didn't see them. They were out of sight. And so you didn't have to have this pull on your heartstrings. It just wasn't there. And so you avoided that. Well, bring it down to our level. What happens? You go into a restaurant and, this is a nice occasion, and you sit down at a nice table, and then suddenly you look out the window and there you see a hungry man. What do you do? Well, if you're like most people, you don't get up from the table and say, well, I think I'm going to invite that hungry man in to have dinner with us. Well, the restaurant wouldn't like it. He's not dressed too well. It wouldn't be very nice. But most people, what they do? They tell the maitre d', the light shining in that window there, and if you just pull the blinds, it wouldn't distract me. But of course, when you pull the blinds, the hungry man is gone, and now you can you can go on with your sumptuous meal. Human nature, is very strange. The human heart is deceitful above all things, and so we can just close out and by just pulling the blinds. We don't have to watch that hungry man. We don't have to be distressed. And it's, out of sight, out of mind, and we can go on and enjoy it. Churchill referred to the members of the Soviet Politburo as the bloody-minded professors of the Kremlin. And they were a ruthless bunch. The group of men in Germany that had to do with the extermination of the Jews and all undesirable classes, they were called the Gauleiters. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but there were 20 people that became professional killers, murderers. They developed the system of killing people into an art, a state of art that is unbelievable to this day. Society pinches themselves and wonders how they could kill systematically so many millions of people. Well, there was one of the 20, there was one university professor, 8 lawyers, one dental surgeon, one architect, one art expert, one ex-pastor, and only 5 on that committee were men without education. But we see that they devised a system of professional killing that was unparalleled in history. They made all the other persecutions and so on look pretty puny compared to what they did. And, they employed psychologists. And Germany had some of the best psychologists and most advanced psychology in the world at that time. And they plotted everything scientifically so that when the people would go into the gas chambers, they didn't want them to panic and go into hysteria, knowing that they would go into death. That would slow down the killing process. So they had it all figured out by playing soft music, and maybe they would put a bouquet of flowers there, and they would tell the people, well, you're going in to take a shower and clean up, and the people kind of sensed that maybe it wasn't right, but you couldn't believe that with that soft music playing and those beautiful flowers there, that they were going to kill you. You just couldn't believe it. And people psychologically wouldn't become hysterical until the door slammed and the gas was released in the chamber. Then they'd pile up at the door. But they had this down to a science, and they used all available information to make this the most professional, educated system of killing that ever existed in the world to this date. It was demonic all the way. Well, I'm not singling them out either. They were dupes of Satan. We want to pass on here. But in the makeup of things of the human heart, almost every noble attribute that we have, courage, honor, love, faith, duty, loyalty, can be transmuted into ruthlessness. Courage for the right can sometimes be translated into courage or boldness in what we might will to be right. And there may be a lot of willfulness associated with it. Honor of God is distorted easily into honor of self while we undertake something for God. God is in the background and we can be in the foreground. So, the human heart is deceitful. Love for God and truth and brethren can be indistinguishable from some proclaimed cause which is supposed to be for the love of God and the truth and the brotherhood. You'll be surprised how quickly those who stand in the way of some proclaimed cause or movement can be brushed aside and badly treated. Hope with all its heavenly radiance can be detoured into paths really away from our true hope. Faith can be transferred from the truth of God's promises to the sin of presumption. Duty can become callous repetition. It can become cold indifference. We can just go on and do our job. Just the Germans, some of them, were just doing their job. It was their duty. They felt. Loyalty can be transmuted to stubbornness. And stubbornness, you know, is like rebellion. And in 1 Samuel 15:23, Samuel tells us that rebellion is as the sin of what? Witchcraft. It's no different. It's the same thing as witchcraft, rebellion. Now, compassion tempers a soul. It is the antitoxin for the most poisonous impulses that, you know, we all have a certain amount of these impulses. And compassion is the quality that tempers our toxins. Compassion is the antitoxin for the toxins that of sin that are in our heart. I just want to read briefly from Isaiah 58:2-11. I don't know that I'll read it all, but you know, here we find there was a lot in the scriptures about fasting. The Pharisees used to fast twice a week, and they would stand in the marketplace with long faces, and everyone would know they're fasting for the Lord. But the Lord wanted a different kind of fasting. And in Isaiah 58, he tells you the kind of fast that he wants. Isaiah 58:3, "Why have they fasted, and thou seest not? Why have we humbled ourselves, and thou takest no knowledge of it? Behold, in the day of your fast you seek your own pleasure and oppress all your workers. Behold, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to hit with wicked fist. Fasting like yours this day will not make your voice to be heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day a man to humble himself? Is it to bow down his head like a rush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this a fast and a day acceptable to the Lord? Is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then shall your light break forth like dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer, and you shall cry, and he will say, 'Here am I.'" That's what the Lord wanted. He wanted compassion in the inward parts. Never mind this fasting with a long face. He wanted them to break the oppression, to be kind and compassionate with their fellow men. We know, for instance, in the story of Joseph, the brothers of Joseph were not very compassionate. The only one that showed a little compassion was Reuben. He didn't want to see Joseph killed, and he hit him in a pit with the idea that he would let him loose when his brothers went away. But when he came back, he found his brother was gone. But who was it that got the idea of selling Joseph into slavery? Judah. But, you know, we can learn compassion. When the apostle tells us put on compassion, it doesn't mean that we have it all innately, but it's something we can grow and develop. And here we find that Judah, who was uncompassionate, and even though the pleas of his brother not to sell him into slavery, Judah's heart was hard and he sold him into slavery. But later in Egypt, who was it that was willing to stand instead for Benjamin? It was Judah. He had learned all those years as a conscience oppressed him. Now compassion was in his heart. He wasn't going to let Benjamin stay behind, and he said to Joseph, he didn't know he was his brother, put me in jail. Make me your slave. But don't break my father's heart and keep Benjamin here. He put himself on the block. He had learned compassion. And when Joseph saw this, you know, this is what he was looking for. This is what he was looking for. He was looking to see compassion. And when he saw it in Joseph, he ordered all the Egyptians out. I don't know why, because in Genesis 45:2, he cried so loud that everybody heard him. The Egyptians heard him, and even the household of Pharaoh heard that Joseph was crying like a baby, being reconciled with his brothers. But it was a moment in which he found the quality of compassion, the very quality that was so missing in his brother some years ago. Now, Judah was a compassion. He was a changed man. And so, that's a wonderful lesson. You know, we can learn compassion. That's what we're here for. We're here to learn it. We don't. That's when Paul says, put on compassion. He's not telling you that, oh, you have compassion and just let a little of it out. He's telling you, you've got to develop this. You've got to learn, like Judah, to really put on this quality of compassion. Well, I guess if I'm talking about compassion, I got to be merciful and make this short. But in conclusion, I want to tell a story about the knight, the young knight who decided that he was going to go out and find the Holy Grail. That was going to be his mission in life. And, of course, when he rode out on his mission, the whole world knew that he was going out to find the Holy Grail. And he had all his banners flying on his white charger, and he had on all his shining armor, and he had a pouch full of gold coins, and he rode off on this wonderful mission to find the Holy Grail. And as he rode out through the gate, lo and behold, there was a beggar sitting at the gate of the city, and he looked at him and, on your mission to find the Holy Grail, you really should throw him a gold coin. So he threw the beggar a gold coin, and off he went on his glorious mission. Well, he spent many years unsuccessfully trying to find the Holy Grail and had many, many experiences. But now, he was a broken man. He had failed in his mission. And finally, he returned. Not on a white charger anymore. He was walking. He had rusted armor and, he had all the marks of failure. And as he trudged back toward the city from whence he had left, lo and behold, there at the gate is the beggar, still there. Only this time, he doesn't have a gold coin to toss him. All he has is a hard crust of bread. But he's going to share that with the beggar. So he picks the beggar up and he puts him on a log. And there's a little creek down the road, and he goes and he has a rusty tin cup and he breaks the ice and he gets a cup of water. And he comes and sits alongside of the beggar and puts his cloak around him. And there together, they share this crust of bread. And now, he's not just a beggar at the gate. He's a human being. And they're sharing the warmth of his tattered cloak. And they're sharing this bread together. And they're having fellowship. And it was then that he saw the Holy Grail. May the Lord add his blessing.